You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help. We're joined today by David Oakley, who's an Army officer and former CIA officer who currently serves as an assistant professor at the National Defense University's College of International Security Affairs. He's also the author of Subordinating Intelligence, the DoD-CIA Post-Cold War Relationship. So welcome, David. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast.
Hey, Vince. Thanks for having me.
So you're really uniquely suited to write a book on this subject since you now currently serve as a military officer and you're a former CIA officer. But what got you to this topic? Why is it such a fertile ground for kind of taking it on and analyzing it the way that you did?
Yeah, so you mentioned my background as a former CIA officer and then a current military officer. And through that experience, I was always curious because you look at the OSS, you look at the common lineage, the shared lineage. But anyone who's worked in either organization will realize they're culturally much, much different. And so just, you know, my experience there got me kind of interested in the topic. I was attending a school called the School of Advanced Military Studies, the Army School, and we had to do some research on an operational topic. And so I started to, you know, I looked for a way I could bring my interest in both and also my curiosity about how two organizations, same lineage, but completely different. And so I started researching it then, found a lot of fertile ground, found that there wasn't a lot to do about the relationship or how the relationship evolved over time, and decided to continue with it for my further research.
One thing that's interesting, and we'll go to the bottom line up front right here, right? The core question of this book is like, what is the purpose of intelligence, right? Is it designed to support policymakers, right? The big picture of the president and the National Security Council and like the big strategic issues, or military commanders? I mean, that seems to be the question that has gone back and forth, at least for the last 25 years or so.
So, you know, it's interesting. When I started to do this research, I went to an Intelligence National Security Alliance conference. And I was sitting in the back of the room. And, you know, of course, I have a definition of intelligence that's largely informed by my experience with the CIA as a human officer. And so I was sitting in the back of the room. And what came across to me as I went to these different speakers is we might have an intelligence community, but all these individuals defined intelligence slightly different. So like, for example, you know, being a human officer, you know, we always talked about, you know, clandestinely acquired was one that were the key attributes of the intelligence. But you talk to some other folks and, you know, they focus more on open source collection. And of course, analysts are different than collectors. And so what I found, when I heard that initially, that kind of informed me the way I approached some of my interviews with these individuals, these former leaders in the intelligence community, whether it's from the CIA or the military. And what I found was interesting is some individuals really focused on the support to the warfighter. And so I remember one conversation I had that's laid out in the book when an individual, former senior intelligence officer, said to me that intelligence at best when it identifies the person behind the door. And so it was very tactically oriented. But then I had other individuals who were senior that focused, that told me, hey, we focus too much on tactical intelligence and that affects the quality of information that goes to the policymaker.
Well, it's interesting. Anyone younger than 25 right now may not remember when the CIA was essentially an independent organization that kind of did 30-year estimates on Chinese economy and, you know, looked at leadership analysis. But you really make the point in the book, and we'll get into this and we'll take it apart, that support to military commanders, the kind of the military mission of the CIA, makes it less independent. And as you would kind of the title suggest, potentially subordinate to the DOD, not what it was intended to be when it was created in 1947.
No, I believe that, you know, and part of this is probably, in my view, is, you know, immediately shaped by my experience as a military officer. So while I've never been in military intelligence, I have served on staffs. And, you know, largely when you serve on a staff, you're serving the general officer, the commander, and you're providing him information to enable decision making. And, you know, that is quite tactical, operational in nature. It's much different than the type of information that you would provide a policymaker to provide that understanding. You know, largely it's driven by tactical actions and operation. And it's much more catered and centered around that individual, that commander.
A lot of people focus on the post 9/11 world as kind of the impetus for the current relationship to DOD and CIA, right? 9/11 kind of militarized the CIA, but you argue in the book that it starts way earlier than that. And we're going to get to that. I want to take that apart, but let's at least get our listeners up to date with what is the current relationship between the DOD and the CIA, because it's very different. If you were a CIA officer who retired in the early 1990s, the CIA today would look very, very different to you. I'm talking hundreds of military personnel working at CIA when there was just a handful earlier on. But there are other some key differences too. You want to talk a little bit about some of those?
Yeah, I think, you know, and this is some of the goodness I talk about in the book. And that's one of the, you know, the main arguments I try to put, of course, across in the book, is there's positives from this relationship and there's negatives. I think one of the positive has been this increased familiarity between the CIA and DOD. I mean, you look at stuff like, a recent class at the farm, 25% was military officers going through. And so I think that's very important, especially with all, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, these operations, there's much more familiarity and understanding. I interviewed some folks that had been liaisons to the CIA in the military in the early 90s. And they would describe, you know, maybe a handful of military officers. Today, you go to the CIA, talk to the Associate Director of Military Affairs. There's a lot more interaction between the two. And so that's really, really good. But it's, you know, it's much, much different than it was before 9/11.
Right. The seed for this relationship, as you argue in the book, was planted all the way back in the 1980s. In the early 80s, really kind of look at 83 in Beirut and Grenada, which, you know, a lot of people, there's one movie about it with Clint Eastwood, Heartbreak Ridge. But other than that, Grenada was kind of just forgotten. But for a lot of people in the intelligence community, in the military, it wasn't, because of the real problem with commanders on the ground feeling as though they had really bad intelligence about the dispersion of forces, particularly bad human intelligence.
Yeah. So, you know, Beirut was particularly interesting, especially when I went back through some of the congressional committees that looked at the mistakes leading up to Beirut. And one of the things they blamed was a lack of human intelligence. And it was a lack of human intelligence for force protection, which I found interesting, because and this goes back to assets and, what kind of sources that would be required for someone providing information on issues relevant to policymakers versus issues relevant to commanders on the ground. But Congress was very critical of the CIA and their lack of support to the warfighter on the ground to provide force protection information. And so that really, that and then Grenada around the same time, this lack of, knowledge, battlefield awareness, they were also critical of human intelligence, CIA particularly. And I just found that fascinating, because it seemed like a disconnect in the Congress's appreciation of what the CIA was originally built for and their role in, you know, supporting the military versus their role as supporting the policymaker.
Well, that's the tricky part, because the CIA had just been essentially cleaned, you know, and decimated from one end to the other with Stanfield Turner as CIA director. And they're in a position where if you're going to force them to do a new mission, essentially, you know, provide on the ground tactical intelligence for military commanders without increasing the size of the workforce that's doing human intelligence, it's zero sum. You've got to pull from other places, and pulling from other places meant pulling from the traditional collectors who are doing strategic intelligence.
Yeah, I think it's particularly important when you look at Beirut, and because Beirut, their station was decimated what, like 6 months before in another bombing attack, and so they didn't even have the network or the conditions on the ground, and they had lost a lot of their assets after that attack. So no, it is concerning. And especially, you know, I think some of it might be an ignorance by policymakers on what it actually takes to develop intelligence, to develop assets, who have access to certain sources.
Around the same time, you saw kind of the beginning of this militarization with the creation of Special Operations Command, SOCOM, which gave the CIA a point person inside the DOD, kind of starting this relationship. But also, following Beirut, CIA started to focus more on counterterrorism, which by definition tends to be much more tactical than big picture strategic. And then that kind of already is leading them down the rabbit hole.
No, I agree. And this is where, you know, I walked away from my research, and, you know, it was, I got an appreciation for acknowledging that the CIA has to have a role, and they need a role in counterterrorism, but also appreciating that too much role, too much focus takes them naturally down a tactical kind of mindset. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking back, although this book doesn't really cover it, you know, I think this relationship between, you know, especially if you look at the CIA's paramilitary forces and you look at their broader mission about supporting the policymaker to develop policy or informing policy, this is a tension within the organization that has existed since its founding.
Right. You know? The Gulf War in 91 was really a turning point for kind of this relationship, mainly because of all the kind of the spotlight of attention that was put on the relationship between the CIA and the ability to support warfighters. And a lot of it was General Norman Schwarzkopf kind of openly criticizing the kind of intelligence that they got. And then, you know, SSCI jumps in and was particularly harsh about that relationship. Even to the point where they said that CIA needs to support military commanders in peacetime more than they were. I mean, how do you maintain an independent strategic intelligence organization when even during peacetime, you're being asked to support the military commander?
You know, it's very difficult. And, you know, and especially you look to today, I think it's even more difficult than it was in the 90s when a lot of that rhetoric started. So back then, you know, when they started saying during times of conflict to support the warfighter, when we weren't talking about perpetual conflict.
Right.
When we were talking about, okay, here's the CIA that needs to ramp themselves up to support the warfighter, that was a little more palatable, although I would argue there were some issues with that. But now you look at this perpetual war, you look, you know, when we define the entire globe as kind of a conflict zone, a battle area after 9/11, it becomes very difficult and nearly impossible. And then going back to the 90s, when they started to get this requirement or leverage on them, they were undergoing significant budget cuts.
Right. I mean, that's the trick, is you talk about perpetual war, but the 90s was kind of a perpetual military operation decade, you know, Gulf War. But then you have Somalia, and talk about intelligence failure in Somalia. We find out much later on that bin Laden and crew were basically there operating that whole thing in the Mogadishu, and then the Balkans. It seems to me that, yes, you have this, every from Dan and Patrick Moynihan and everybody else kind of trying to cut back the CIA or eliminate it completely. But then you have Bill Clinton, who really codifies this relationship of the CIA being subordinate to the military with Presidential Decision Directive 35, where they really lay out explicitly that the top intelligence community priority was support military operations.
No, it was. And, you know, I looked at PDD 35 is really one of the most important, because it was articulated by a policymaker that this will be your main objective. And, you know, I think, you know, you look back to also It empowered the combatant commanders a little more also. And so there was this expectation that there wasn't just this support during conflicts, but it was also support to these combatant commanders in developing plans that would be implemented during conflicts. And so, no, I think the PDD 35, while I understand why it occurred at that time, I think was a pretty significant push towards what I refer to as a subordination of CIA to the DOD.
Well, it'd be one thing if this was happening during an increase in funding and resources and personnel for the CIA, but because they're being... I mean, this is the peace dividend, right? The military gets slashed, but so does the intelligence. Maybe arguably the intelligence agencies get slashed even more than the DOD. At the same time, you're asking them to kind of step up on a mission that focuses on supporting the military commanders. It almost guarantees that you overemphasize the tactical versus strategic. You don't have a choice, right?
Yeah.
It seems.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. You know, and if you look at the time, it's a really rough time because you're having them support these operations in Bosnia and Somalia and Kosovo at a time when, you know, the intelligence community was really trying to wrestle with its identity in the post-Cold War world. And not only were they wrestling with their identity, the United States was trying to wrestle with its role and its responsibility in the post 9/11 world. And so I think it was, you know, it wasn't only it was, I hate to say bad time, but it was an unfortunate time for us to take the intelligence community and the CIA particularly and focus them more on supporting the warfighter.
We'll be right back after this.
And now a word from our sponsor, SpyCloud, the leader in operationalizing cybercrime analytics. Traditional threat intelligence is a thing of the past. Cyber criminals are stealing vast amounts of credentials, session cookies, and financial data every day, and it's hard to keep up. SpyCloud is the trusted partner businesses turn to fully understand their darknet exposure risk and neutralize threats before it's too late. SpyCloud alerts your organization as soon as an employee or customer's data appears on the darknet, so you can act faster than bad actors to prevent cyber attacks like ransomware, session hijacking, account takeover, and online fraud. With insights from the industry's largest repository of recaptured data, protect the digital identities and systems most important to your business. Get your free corporate darknet exposure report at spycloud.com/cyberwire and see what information criminals have in their hands today. That's spycloud.com/cyberwire.
Well, I mean, Serbia really, you talk about war in Kosovo, that really highlights this because the CIA not only was not providing big picture strategic information as well as it probably could, but it came directly involved in straight up targeting decisions, which we, you know, we look at that today. Again, anyone younger than 25 would be like, yeah, that's what the CIA does. It picks out people to kill with drones. Yeah. But this was really the first time the CIA is determining particular targeting decisions, and they're not very good at it.
No. And I talk a little bit about in the book, and I use the Chinese embassy as one of the examples. But yeah, we put them in the process of identifying targets, and really, you know, supporting the combatant commander and the forces on the ground to doing a much more tactical type of operation. Right. And yeah, they're, you know, you're taking individuals that are talented individuals, but giving them a mission that they just haven't prepared for, and they don't even have the processes in place to support it. But what I found in, you know, what I found throughout the book is there's many cases throughout the relationship of the CIA DOD from the early 80s till now to where, you know, the intelligence community received tasks, and although it doesn't fit them being, you know, good government officials and team players, they'll do their best to support the mission.
I mean, we also see the Balkans as the beginning of operational use of drones. And while they haven't been armed quite yet, that comes soon thereafter. You really can see how that is kind of the embryonic beginnings of what we see today. I mean, there are CIA personnel that are literally targeters. Like, that's their job today. That didn't exist before this time period. That's a new job. Chris Costa, our executive director, was very involved in the Panama operation. Was it Just Cause? No, yeah. Can't believe I had to slip my mind why the titles are so wonderful. And he was talking about the idea of manhunting and how that hadn't been something that was done by intelligence before 89 in Panama. And so you can kind of see like these things that we're very good at now or that we do a lot of now were just not things the CIA did prior to this 9/11 period or did well.
Yeah, and I agree. You know, there's always been an aspect, I think, of targeting at the CIA, but it was a different type of targeting. So it was, you know, targeting individuals who have access to certain information for recruitment. But you're right. There wasn't this kind of concept of the targeting cycle, like the military talks about the targeting and cycle. And, you know, that's really, it came out, you know, significantly after 9/11, but, you know, it was even earlier with the use of drones and stuff. And I think, you know, you hit on something with the use of drones. One of my conversations that I had, a very fascinating interview, was with retired Admiral Bobby Ray Inman. And he had been on the, he was on Obama's Presidential Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board at the time. And he, you know, he was telling me a story about how he was doing a tour, basically, of some of the intelligence community, and when they took him to talk to him about some of the issues in the intelligence community, they decided to show him a drone strike. And he kind of, you know, he walked away from there kind of wondering, hey, why have we taken our national intelligence capability and focused them on a tactical issue, on a drone strike? And his perspective, I thought, was very fascinating, and I think it highlights a larger issue that kind of drives this. His perspective was, you know, a lot of this is driven by the policymaker. We have policymakers who are infatuated with kind of tactical operations, with James Bond type of stuff. And that's the kind of things they want. And so these organizations, what they naturally do is they, you know, there's an element of you want to support these policymakers. And when the policymaker is focusing on drone strikes and utilizing that to, you know, decide, I guess, to quantify success, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that some of our national intelligence organizations are focused on that also.
Well, I mean, the instant gratification for a lot of the policymakers. Mm-hmm. They're thinking, you know, what can I do within my 4 or 8 year presidency? So they're less worried or thinking about the 30-year economic outlook about China. Mm-hmm. You know, China 2050 doesn't mean a lot to someone who's not going to be president in a couple mm-hmm. years. And, you know, the idea of turning the CIA into a push button, gee whiz, let's see the bad guy blow up. Mm-hmm. And that makes me happy. Again, regardless of political affiliation, that can be something that you can show your voters or you can show your, you know, your supporters. And that just the politics, you know, politicization of the intelligence just has so many different parameters to that. Right. Yeah. This is one that you're not talking about Republican or Democrat here. You're talking about the idea of someone needs something to help them stay in power. And here's a way to do that. I mean, I would think back to the gee whizness of the Desert Storm stuff where, you know, General Horner and others are showing the pictures of the videotape of the bombs going off and taking out the U.S., the Iraqi Air Force headquarters and stuff. That was justifying all the money.
Yeah.
Right. So that was just me going off in a direction I didn't need to. So let's talk about post 9/11. This book is very apolitical. It's one that, you know, just kind of walks the operational, tactical, strategic, you know, academic line. But there is a quasi villain in the post 9/11 world, and that's former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. You've identified him as a major reason for kind of the increased subordination, the attempted increased subordination of the CIA to the DOD. Mm-hmm. In particular, things like he was annoyed that the CIA had boots on the ground before anybody else did in Afghanistan, and kind of almost this personal kind of vendetta against CIA and wanting to make DOD not only independent, but in charge.
Yeah. Now, I think it's interesting. I think a lot of that, you know, I think there is some personality involved. And I think when you see him leave that position and you know, he's replaced by a much more parochial individual in Bob Gates, I think you see a lot of the relationship improve. But, you know, and I think part of what he drove, he being Rumsfeld, drove, you know, around this time we started doing we gave SOCOM the mission. right? United States gave SOCOM the mission for the counterterrorism fight throughout the globe. Basically, in what I argue in the book is, making the whole globe a battlefield. And so Rumsfeld could argue, I'm not doing intelligence collection. I do not need to coordinate with the CIA in those countries. I'm doing intelligence preparation of the battlefield.
Right. And that's a magical phrase. Yeah. Where, I mean, you see so many of them in the global war on terror corner. That even that itself is a nice little phrase. But there's so many things that kind of allow for unheard of or unthought of ways of doing business, where you redefine things as certain. And this is one of these amazing things where if the whole world is a potential battlefield, then there's no such thing as doing standard human intelligence collection anymore, because everything has potential to be a battlefield. At some point.
No, yeah, you're correct. And, it also expands. And I think, and that was initially one of the things that really, under Rumsfeld, I think ruffled feathers at the CIA. And I would say rightly so. He looked at it as, and I think part of it was, he was a little offended that, the CIA could get into Afghanistan faster. He was not happy with some of the roles the CIA was taking upon, and so he wanted his organization to take a lead. And so he looked at it as, "Hey, I'm going to define this not as foreign intelligence collection, but as intelligence preparation on the battlefield." And from the CIA's perspective, that disrupts the foreign intelligence collections you're talking about. I mean, it's and then also I think it sends a message to allies, and this is kind of another point, but when you call the whole world a battlefield and you're doing intelligence preparation on the battlefield, I think it also conveys a message that I'm not certain we want.
Well, I mean, you alluded to the fact that it might disrupt foreign intelligence collection. I mean, that's the nightmare scenario for CIA, is that they've been working years to develop assets and resources in places that may not be about, it's not, we're not talking about Afghanistan. We may be talking about the Philippines, or we may be talking about, Pakistan or sub-Saharan Africa, and places that we've had case officers, trying to create sources and everything else. And then all of a sudden DIA or the DOD comes stomping in there with their own preparation of the battle space and could burn everything that CIA has been trying to do for decades at that point.
Yeah. You also offend our allies and our partners in some of those areas that we have liaison relationships with. When you have Rumsfeld wanting to do intelligence preparation on the battlefield and not making the CIA station chief aware of what's going on or the intelligence community aware of what they're doing, our allies who we have liaison partners can find out, and that, tarnishes our broader U.S. relationship with those allies.
You were very euphemistic and very ambassadorial when you said tarnishes our relationship. It can make us look like frickin' idiots. And I really mean euphemistic in saying that. If one hand, the DIA and the CIA don't know what each other are doing. Another real issue for Rumsfeld was the establishment of the DNI. And this is something that, it hasn't been around long enough for us to fully judge it. I mean, I'm a historian. It's going to be around a lot longer for me to give it kind of a up or down. But he did not like the DNI very much. He fought against it in the beginning, and then when he saw that it was going to happen regardless, he looked to try to weaken its ability to be a clearinghouse for intelligence.
No, and it's interesting. He even got even butted heads with some of his underlings, and so
right, very famously named underlings.
Yes, yes, yeah. future yes. DNI. Yeah, he didn't like it, and I wonder, and I around the same time he established Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. Although this was a position I think that he was pushing for even back during the Carter administration, he was looking for how do I unify intelligence within DOD? And so as a leader of DOD, I can appreciate why he'd want to do that, want to have that single belly button he could hit. But I wonder if there was also a part of this not liking the DNI into what motivated his viewpoint of having an undersecretary of defense.
Well, the USD for intelligence, though, was under his, basically was not part of the IC. It was kind of specifically just focused on the defense side of things. And you had mentioned the idea that when Jim Clapper, who was the NGA director, and Mike Hayden, who was the NSA director, two intelligence agencies that are considered kind of independently part of the IC, but are under the DOD auspices, their Department of Defense agencies, argued that they should be part of the DNI more broadly and not under the DOD. Rumsfeld wanted nothing to do with it.
No, he basically scolded them. For you know, basically you work for me,
right?
You know, your main job and your main hat, you might have a national intelligence mission, but your most important role is supporting DOD. And, you know, more importantly, you work for me.
Well, that's amazing to think of. You think about the NSA and kind of its global strategic view versus kind of tactical stuff. I mean, that's, I'm wondering if there's a historian out there that someday is going to do kind of research into that relationship and see the direction the NSA took with some of the metadata collection and stuff that was focused much more on tactical, stopping a terrorist attack coming tomorrow, which, look, it's understandable, but in taking away from SIGINT that was more focused on what Russia was doing or what China was doing and other things because of Rumsfeld and the direction that he made the NSA go in under Mike Hayden.
Now, I think that would be a very interesting project to do. You know, and during a lot of my interviews, when it goes to signals and stuff, a lot of people point out, hey, you know, signals is a little less difficult, a little less concerning when you talk about, you know, a militarization, I guess, or a subordination to DOD from the collection standpoint. Because, you know, we can scoop up all the signals. Right. But from an analytical standpoint, you know, I'm, you know, largely ignorant of, you know, and I think it would be a good research. And what did, during that time period, what did the analysts focus on? Were the analysts focused on supporting the warfighter, or were the analysts focused on supporting the policymaker?
Right. You'd already mentioned about personalities mattering, and you've talked a little bit about how kind of Rumsfeld rub people the wrong way. I say that five times fast. After he left, there were really this kind of group of men who made the relationship that much better. We've already talked about Clapper and Hayden. You talked about Bob Gates already, but Michael McConnell is a name that hasn't come up yet. People don't necessarily think of him. If I think back about the DNIs, he's not the one that's on the top of my list. He's kind of forgotten. But his inclusion in this relationship with Clapper, Hayden, and Gates really is what transformed, or at least cleaned up some of the mess after Rumsfeld left the Pentagon.
Yeah, McConnell is a fascinating character, and I was fortunate enough to be able to interview him. But I think a lot of people forget he was the J-2 during Desert Storm. And so, and if you look back to his time as J-2, he really did some remarkable stuff in supporting the combatant commander Schwarzkopf. You know, the creation of the Joint Intelligence Center within combatant commands, reaching out to NSA, reaching out to CIA, really getting the national intelligence community to support the warfighter. And then I agree with you when you look to see when he becomes DNI, I think he brought that knowledge with him and he understood, I think both the importance of having a partnership between national intelligence and the warfighter, but also the importance that they had, or that they had distinct missions too that we couldn't forget. Right. So I think he was also, all those individuals, be it Gates, McConnell, Hayden, Clapper, I think them being the positions they were after Rumsfeld left was very valuable to improving the relationship. I think
even those at the bottom up too, I think field commanders like Petraeus and McChrystal and others who, maybe that's a double-edged sword argument here too, because you have these generals that become CIA directors and stuff. Maybe there is too much, you know, incestuous relationship there between the two, but certainly that helped the relationship build and grow when you don't have this butting heads between CIA and DOD.
No, I think it did. I think on the grassroots level, the relationship has been very, very good. I think typically where the relationship has been a little more, rocky is at the higher levels. But I do think this, whether it's Petraeus and his experience working with the CIA and appreciation of it. I think that has been valuable for the relationship.
Well, another thing that happened is the Undersecretary of Defense kind of became more of an integral member of the intelligence community and not just the DOD. That seems to have mattered a little bit in the last decade or so.
Yeah. And then you, with the USDI, you mean with the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think if you look, and I apologize as the name escapes me right now, but the USDI,
P People can look it up. Never memorize anything you can look up. You're good.
But no, I agree. And the USDI, and I think it depends on the role they decided to take too. So initially you look at someone like Cambone, who was run with Rumsfeld's folks. And I'm not, I think a little less critical of Cambone, but he was very parochial in his relationship and he was really focused on the department. Later USDIs, I think were less parochial. And I think it helped the relationship kind of recover from the Rumsfeld years.
So let's go back to the bottom line, because why is it an issue? As your book title suggests, why would it be an issue if CIA was subordinate to the Pentagon? Kind of big picture.
So I think it goes back to, it goes back to 1947 and the purpose of the CIA. And you look back then with way, whether it was a Dulles Gray commission or others who said we really need an independent intelligence organization to really provide unbiased analysis to the policymakers. As soon as we subordinate it to another organization, we lose that unbiased analysis. And I think we really lose having an independent intelligence organization. It becomes independent intelligence organization name only. And so whenever we say, hey, your main function is to support the warfighter, your main function is to ensure that they have the intelligence for planning, we push it a little more towards, a little less or away from independence.
Well, and you also run the risk of really dropping the ball on big picture strategic intelligence. I mean, that's where more than anything else, the CIA was designed to do, right? The CIA in 47 wasn't just designed to be independent. It was designed to pick up on future threats, on the big picture, whether it's the Soviet nuclear threat or the Chinese threat or anything else. And if you're focused on Al-Qaeda all the time and focused on tactical intelligence, you might miss those big threats coming down the pipe.
Yeah, and I would say not just the big kind of threat, the strategic warning, but I think also the appreciation of it's bubbling underneath. No. And so, this understanding of the world that policymakers need to have, this understanding of kind of the flows of where it's going, when you get focused on, kind of the supporting the warfighter, you lose sight of that. And I think it's tied back to that conversation we had earlier about the drone strikes and looking, just at, how successful are we at just taking out targets and not, okay, what's this broader appreciation I have of the world?
Isn't there even a big picture argument here than even just the CIA of the kind of broader DOD supremacy over U.S. foreign policy writ large? Yeah. I mean, the idea everything's been militarized, almost a solve all, right? And, it's mixed into popular culture and popular understanding of kind of there are very few parades and Wounded Warrior Project for CIA personnel or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's all kind of this. And look, we're both, you're current military, I'm ex-military. We obviously have appreciation for the soldiers and sailors, airmen and Marines out there. But there has been a lazy foreign policy in the last 20 years of sending the Marines or sending the SEALs or sending someone instead of sending USAID or sending the Peace Corps or sending some diplomats or, agency personnel. It's kind of it used to be an emergency break glass and send in the Marines. Now that's like the first 10 options, and then it's maybe we'll do some diplomacy later on.
No, I think it is. And that's, it's interesting. My original title was Militarizing Intelligence. But it was, I spoke to some friends about it and they had some good comments that it could be mistaken that, maybe the CIA shouldn't be involved in paramilitary. And that wasn't what I was trying to get at. Although I realized the tension in being involved in paramilitary, it's a mission the CIA has had for some time. But I do agree with you that I think, and I argue in the book, that this is a symptom of the broader, what I call militarization of foreign policy, or not what I call militarization of foreign policy, what others have called militarization of foreign policy. And I think a lot of it has to do with, there's this huge trust, I don't know if you call it trust or huge focus placed on DOD, and a lot of influence given to combatant commanders. And one of the things, we in the military, we talk about shaping, And so there's this role, not just during combat operations or during times of war, but there's this shaping our influence throughout the globe. And I think over time, this role of the combatant commanders shaping the environment has given them kind of a dominant position in foreign affairs. To me, I end with this in the book. It's disconcerting.
Right.
And so, as you say, we want to support the troops. We want to find balance. And what is interesting is, and this isn't, you know, a few people who initially commented on the book say, hey, you know, Dave, you might come across as anti-DOD.
Right.
Which is, if they know where I get my paycheck, they realize that that's, you know, kind of funny. And of course, this is my own personal opinion and not the DOD's opinion. But I don't think I'm alone when you look at military professionals who have voiced concern over this militarization of foreign policy.
Well, people will accuse me of that anyway, so I'll just jump right in and say, I mean, there's a little bit of a tail wagging the dog here, too. When they have an $800 billion defense budget, you need to find a place to drop your bombs. You know, and when you're, you know, when less than 1% of the budget is foreign aid and other things like that, too. But Jim Mattis was interesting when he talked about during his confirmation hearings, and I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially he's like, if you don't give more money to the State Department diplomats, then you better buy me a lot more bullets, mm-hmm. right? The idea is there are people who I think are thinking in the same way you are, where there has been a militarization of foreign policy, and it's not just the Trump administration. It goes back mm-hmm. way before that, where the solution to the problem is send in the Green Berets or send in the SEALs instead of a more foggy bottom based thing versus a Pentagon based thing.
No, I think you're right. I think part of it is maybe it's just human nature. We're biased towards action. Yeah. And so we think that by action itself, we're achieving something. And so we push, you know, send the military and, you know, the action itself, people feel like we're moving towards success. And to me, that's problematic. I think many times we would just sit back and kind of relax and try to gain a better appreciation of the environment and not just move towards action.
Yeah, I'm asking these questions because you are a professor at the National Defense University, so I'll wax philosophic with you. But it's not just a militarization of foreign policy. It's really focused more on the tactical, the strategic, even mm-hmm. at the foreign policy perspective, right? The strategic thinking about foreign policy is thinking long-term, diplomatic, right? Or the George Kennans of the world going back and saying, all right, here's what the next 40 years are going to look like, versus a militarization of foreign policy was all about the tactical. Who can we kill tomorrow? You know, who can we go in and what territory can we take, or how can we pacify a certain area? And it's not necessarily thinking about 20, 30, 40 years from now. I think that this might not be a symptom of the militarization of foreign policy. It might be a symptom of the tactification, or I'm making up a word, if it doesn't exist, a foreign policy versus long-term thinking.
Yeah, it becomes more transactional, right?
Yeah.
We're focused more on the individual transaction, not broadly how it kind of fits together. And, you know, as you mentioned, I teach at NDU, and one of the things we always try to talk to our students is, you know, appreciating the role of all the different organizations within, you know, we use DIME, you know, diplomatic, information, military, economic, and the different organizations that they represent, and you know, not just action, but understanding the environment. Because I think although we've come a long way in DOD, in appreciating our partners throughout the interagency, I think we still look in, and I mentioned this a little bit in the book, we still look at a lot of them as a supporting effort.
Yeah.
So our supported effort. And so it's, you know, we need a little bit of that diplomacy, or we need a little bit of that economic, and not from a standpoint that, you know, let us understand the environment, and realize that there's not one dominant, agency or department, and that we all have roles to play.
Well, it's interesting that the combatant commanders, if you put them on kind of like a line chart with the geographical specialist from CIA, who essentially would be the same ballpark as a combatant mm-hmm. commander, or the geographical specialist from State Department, they have far less power within their organizations. So the Middle East guy at State has way less power than the CENTCOM commander relatively to their organizations. And the geographic, you know, whoever does, you know, South Asia or Southwest Asia for CIA has way less power than, again, as a four-star CENTCOM commander. And just kind of the And so if they're working together, there's a clear hierarchy, even if one is not delineated by law.
No, and I agree. And, you know, I always point to people. I remember when AFRICOM was stood up a few years back, I guess, what, 07, 08, I can't remember the exact time frame. But if you remember, it was very unique because they said that the deputy was going to be an ambassador. And, you know, we're applauding our interagency approach. But it was the deputy.
Right.
You know, it was the combatant commander was still in charge.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's an issue. In the book, I argue a lot of this has to do with Goldwater Nichols. Mm-hmm. And I think Goldwater Nichols, and as I mentioned before, there's the costs and the benefits. I think the benefit of Goldwater Nichols, we organized, we being the DOD organized much better as an entity. It empowered the combatant commanders to kind of focus on their regions. But I think the cost with that organization, it also helped DOD gain more influence over others.
Well, that's the thing. Goldwater Nichols was designed to reorganize the DOD, but the unintended consequence was that it reorganized all foreign policy really under the auspices of the Department of Defense.
Oh, it did.
Yeah,
definitely. I agree with you. And I think that's why we're this – the empowerment that it gave DOD, I think what we see now is because of that empowerment. So
the book is extraordinarily good when it comes to really getting wonky. And if you want to get wonky, this is the book to get wonky. And those out there, don't let that scare you. It's certainly readable. It's something that most of us don't think a whole lot about. It's kind of these high-level relationships between DOD and CIA and these other agencies and how it developed into what it is today. The book is called Subordinating Intelligence, the DOD-CIA Post-Cold War Relationship. The author is David Oakley. David, thank you so much again for joining us here on SpyCast. We truly appreciate it.
Hey, Vince, thank you for this great opportunity.